back to another episode of E-commerce on Tap, brought to you by Sourcify and ISBA. I'm your host, Nathan Resnick, joined by my co-host, Aaron Alperter. Aaron, what's going on? Give us a quick rundown of what we do at E-commerce on Tap.
Yeah, Nathan, I have been looking forward to these. This is like the highlight of my week. I love getting ready for these. I love chatting with you. At E-commerce on Tap, basically what we do is we find a well-known venture-backed company. We tell their founding story and then reverse engineer their supply chain. And we have an awesome episode today. Talking about Athletic Brewing. We seem to be on a drink kick recently, but Athletic Brewing is really changing the game as far as how non-alcoholic beers are considered.
Yeah, I mean, I'm excited for Athletic Brewing. I think it's pretty crazy just on a high level to see they are the number one quote-unquote beer sold at Whole Foods. So we're going to dive deep into the founding story in terms of the history of beer, in terms of how they get started, their growth, their fundraising, their supply chain, really all the ins and outs. That's what we do at E-commerce on Tap. But before we get into the Athletic Brewing story, what caught your eye this past week, Aaron?
Yeah, so there were two things. The first one is that Walmart is now selling AI-powered logistics software. I don't know if you saw that.
I didn't. No, tell us about it.
Yeah, so basically they have a route optimization tool that's helping solve some middle mile problems. And so, you know, effectively Walmart said, hey, we're solving this problem for ourselves. This is probably something that other people will be willing to pay for. And now they're rolling out. So it's a smaller sort of dip in there. But I think it's really interesting to see the world's largest retailer now going into software. And I think that we're going to see more and more of this. I know that a lot of the aggregators that I talk to, they are spending a lot of effort building software to automate and eliminate a lot of the work that's going on there. And I think that as the aggregator business goes through this revaluation period, their businesses themselves may not be as valuable as the tech that they're creating. And so my prediction is that in 2 to 3 years, we're probably going to see a lot of SaaS companies come out of these aggregators or come out of big companies like this that have the access to the data, that have the use cases. And if you can do something that solves your problem and you can spin that out to another company, you have a guaranteed keystone client and you can start helping other people, that just is an amazing fit. So I'm really excited about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone wants some SaaS revenue, right? So pretty interesting to see that Walmart's going after and taking that angle as well. Anything else that caught your eye?
Yeah, another one was Starlink. So Elon Musk's space internet that goes on. I read an article about how there is a black market for these Starlink modules and how the Russian military is now using them. There's this whole shadow thing of people buying them through different entities and then making them over to Russia. And so they're not selling directly there, but they're also, you know, like not turning off the internet that they could. And so it's really interesting thing, because if you look at the war in Ukraine, Starlink was one of the competitive advantages that the Ukrainian army had for a period there. They had connectivity. You can't jam this. You can't shut it down. And so they were able to do things that the Russians weren't able to do. And so now that this advantage has kind of somewhat been leveled, some people are looking at this and saying, all right, is this the reason why there's a stalemate? Is this the reason why things are not moving as well for the Ukrainians as maybe they had in years past? And so there's a lot of other things that go into that, and that's not the point of this podcast, but I just thought it was really interesting how, you know, commerce is kind of like water. It finds the path of least resistance. And sometimes, even though we have trade barriers and we have set things, it's going to find its way to where there's a market.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's a interesting point about commerce and just how it really, you know, moves across borders, if you will. So that's cool. I think what caught my eye is Triple Whale launched their AI product. I think a lot of these like early AI product iterations are just kind of chat interfaces to chat with your data. And though I think this will get better and better, I think right now, you know, this is just like the first step of what a lot of these SaaS companies that sell to e-commerce brands are going to do when it comes to AI. So I didn't think it was like super special per se. I mean, I think a lot of what it does, you can already do manually, but now you kind of chat and interact with your AI or with your data using their AI. So it was a neat tidbit, but I didn't think it was like super crazy. But let's dive in. I mean, Athletic Brewing, let's start with the history of beer and this kind of like non-alcohol movement and industry that Athletic Brewing leads today.
Yeah. So interesting enough, if I had to ask you, and you can't cheat because you have the notes, but just for our listeners out there, if you had to guess when the first beer was made, where was it made and how far ago? So what did you think before we did the research on this?
Yeah, I would have said like Dublin, Ireland, like, I don't know, 2 or 3,000 years ago. And I don't know, when I think of beer, I think of Dublin, probably because Guinness and just them having their headquarters there. That's what I would think.
Yeah, I would have guessed Germany, 1,000 years ago, something like that. We would have both been way wrong. So the first record of beer being produced was actually done by the Chinese in 7,000 BCE. So humans have been making beer and beer derivatives for over 9,000 years, which is just mind-blowing. But non-alcoholic beer is a relatively new phenomenon. And so we're going to skip all of the 7,000 BCE stuff, and we'll kind of get to Prohibition in the 1920s. And this concept of near beer, which was effectively non-alcoholic beer, this came to prominence during Prohibition because it was the only way for the brewers to survive. Again, remember, this is something that a lot of the immigrants had brought over. They had breweries that were had thriving businesses prior to Prohibition, and when the law was passed, they had to figure out something to do, and they couldn't moonshine or bootleg because people knew where they were. These breweries were pretty big. And so they started creating something that was near beer. And so that's how they did it. So that was how they survived. After Prohibition, the people decided, hey, we don't like this. We want the other stuff. And it was probably because the quality was awful. We'll get to that. And so that kind of faded away. And in the 1970s, in Texas, there was one of the first relevant non-alcoholic beer brewers came into existence. And what they were doing is they were brewing their beer in Texas, and they were exporting it to the Middle East. And this is because alcohol still is, and it was at that point, illegal in many places. And so they were shipping them to Canada and Korea and other places that had some restrictions on alcohol. And then you fast forward to the 1990s, and there was a brand called O'Doul's, which I know I've heard of. But O'Doul's was launched in the market, making the first mainstream non-alcoholic beer. And it was pretty widely available, is pretty widely available across the US. And it was really the first introduction that most modern consumers had around non-alcoholic beer. And so this is really something that had been around for over a century. And it wasn't really until we get to the 2010s, the 2000, early 2020s, when the craft beer movement is really picking up. And it seemed like all my friends had stuff in their garages, and you hear about all these breweries that are popping up everywhere. In Charlotte, it seems like there's a brewery every 5 miles. And so it's like a really big thing. But these craft brewers and people playing with things really started to allow people to experiment with non-alcoholics as well. And so since 2015, non-alcoholic beers have more than doubled those imports. And they're growing by about 30% year over year. So non-alcoholic beer is about 90% of the total market. And those number of drinkers have increased by about 8x since 2020.
That's pretty fascinating in terms of just how non-alcoholic beer came to be. And I think what's interesting too is that from my understanding, like the top 80% of non-alcoholic beer drinkers is between the ages of 21 and 44, but only 43% of beer drinkers are within that same age range. So it seems like this kind of like near beer, non-alcoholic beer market is really geared towards kind of people in their 20s, 30s, and early 40s for the most part, which is an interesting dynamic because I think on one hand, like you said, you have that craft beer market that grew like crazy, and there's breweries all over the place right now. But I'm curious, like, what was kind of the inspiration for the founders to start Athletic Brewing? I mean, was it they saw this near beer market growing and saw an empty white space in that industry? What kind of was their aha moment, if you will?
Yeah, this is a great story. And like you said, the non-alcohol movement in general, whether it's spirits or wines or beer, it's really having a moment right now. And more people are kind of questioning if they should be drinking or drinking as much as they are. And so one of the key founders, his name is Bill Schufelt. And he is originally from Darien, Connecticut. It's a beautiful place. I used to live nearby. And he went to Middlebury College in Vermont. He was a D1 athlete. He was a defensive lineman for the football team. And I don't know if you've been to Vermont recently, but it is awesome for many reasons. But one of the things that makes you Vermont quirky is that they have this really robust craft brew culture. There's lots of interesting breweries. I remember we've got friends that said, oh, you know, there's certain breweries that are only open in the winter because you have to get there by snowmobile. And like, that's the context. That's where he kind of came to age and fell in love with us. And so he listed a couple breweries that he really loved, like Otter Creek Brewery, Long Trail Brewing, Magic Hat. And that really got him interested. And so you think about, like, just as a side note with Vermont in general, it's one of the highest selling beer, like, per capita states when it comes to beer. And so it's really ingrained in the culture and the social life. And if you're someone who isn't drinking or doesn't want to drink, you can kind of stick out like a sore thumb. And so that's an important context of what he had and just understanding the social aspect of what was there. Well, Bill, he graduated from Middlebury College. He got a degree in economics and initially started a career in finance. So it was, I think, 2005. He started healthcare stocks and worked for a few hedge funds, including Steve Cohen's hedge fund, Point 72. And he kind of just said, like, he sleepwalked his way into finance. He never really intended to be an entrepreneur. And so it kind of comes with this context of, you know, he has this, he's an athlete, he's health-minded, he's working in this environment that is very social in finance, and he has this love of craft beer and that culture that comes through.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting because he didn't necessarily start out wanting to be an entrepreneur, right? It's not like he saw some crazy data point of, you know, non-alcoholic beer growing by X percent a year. For him, it kind of seemed like it stemmed more so from his love for athletics. And, you know, he was a marathon runner, right? So he had gotten really into marathon running and obviously recognized that, hey, you know, though I enjoy craft beer, it's not helping my training. And so he decided to give up drinking in 2013. And so, you know, during the week he would attend work dinners and, you know, four nights a week, it's like every work dinner, a lot of work dinners involve alcohol, right? Whether it be beer or wine or whatever it may be. And I think when, I guess at dinner with his wife, Jackie, he kind of started tinkering and thinking about, you know, what if I could create like a really cool non-alcoholic craft beer? And his wife like grabbed his shoulder and said, you know, you should do this, right? You should do this. Because I think at the time, you know, so much of work culture was involving alcohol with these happy hours or dinners. And I think he was probably in a bit of a hard position, like many of us have been, where you're at, you know, a work dinner or a cocktail hour or whatever it may be, and there are no options that are, you know, non-alcoholic beers. I mean, you know, you could get a soda, but that's it. And then sometimes you might feel like an outsider if you're drinking a soda. I don't know. So I think it's kind of interesting to see that it was almost like a personal pain point for him to realize, hey, you know, beer is affecting my training for marathons. And I also like don't have an option when I go to these work events at a brewery.
Yeah. And it, you know, it's as someone who doesn't drink, I can definitely relate to the feeling of outsideness that you can have. And so, it's funny, we used to do happy hours when I was at Unilever, and we would go and everyone would be drinking. And I'm like, well, I'm just going to order a burger. And they're like, why are you getting dinner? I'm like, well, I spent the same amount for food. And anyway, so I can definitely feel his pain. And, you know, I love that the context of his wife, where here he is complaining about the lack of options and how just the non-alcoholic craft beer things just suck. And she says, well, stop complaining. You go figure it out. And it's like, that's no big deal. So I think to his wife's credit, she pushed him to pursue something that maybe he wouldn't have done otherwise.
Yeah, definitely. And I think too, when he had this idea, it wasn't like, hey, you know, this is going to be easy to do, because at the time, there wasn't like a go-to process to brew non-alcoholic beer, right? So alcoholic beers, they have a few key steps when it comes to brewing them. You know, first, what a lot of people consider the most important is the actual grain and malt are combined and passed through a grist mill, which basically cracks open the kernels and exposes the sugar inside. Then hot water is added to the mixture, where it steeps for a period of time, creating like an oatmeal-like mash. As the mash boils, a sugary liquid called wort is created and transferred into a brewing tank. The wort is usually boiled for around 90 minutes, and this is when it hops and other aromatics are added to create a unique taste and a flavor profile. And so I think that's where, you know, a lot of these tastes come out when it comes to different beer. But after the boil, the wort can be further processed to create different types of beers, right? So for like ales and lagers, it's transferred through a heat exchanger that helps to rapidly cool the liquid before it's pumped into a fermentation vessel. Yeast will be added. And so this is kind of where you get different types of beer. And so I'm not, you know, a brewing expert here by any means, but, you know, I think it is interesting when you go to some of these breweries and you see these large, you know, vats of beer. I mean, it's being fermented and it's a pretty cool process, but the non-alcoholic process was a bit tricky in terms of the process that they used to, you know, make it non-alcoholic, right? So it seems like it was just a harder process to make non-alcoholic beer. Aaron, I'm curious, like, I mean, what do you think about the alcoholic beer process versus, do you want to dive into the non-alcoholic beer process?
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. So if you if you're bored and you want to get on YouTube and just take a look at, I mean, beer manufacturing is interesting because it is no two breweries are exactly the same. The differences in the temperature and the mix of products that they're using, the equipment, how they do different things, like it is truly different, which is why the craft beer environment works is because, you know, stuff in my garage is going to taste different from stuff in your garage. And so regardless of how that uniqueness is, they all have these same steps. And they get to that point that you were talking about with the wort, where they basically add in the yeast, and that yeast is what creates the alcohol, right? The yeast eats the sugars, creates the alcohol. And the thing is interesting is that there's all of this attention to detail and all of these steps and all of this nuance that goes in there. And that is the same whether you're making an alcoholic beer or non-alcoholic beer. And the difference is that with a non-alcoholic beer, you take this product that you have nurtured and taken care of for a week or two, and you basically like burn the crap out of it. Like you're trying to boil off the alcohol, and that's how they do it, right? And so it's almost like a very blunt force sort of approach to a very delicate environment that's going through. And so yes, they successfully create something without alcohol, but they leave behind something that doesn't taste quite right, right? It could be burnt. The texture, the flavors, everything is very different because of this kill step at the end that effectively kills all of, that just destroys that taste and things like that. So that's why historically non-alcoholic beers have really just sucked.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely, I think, less of a craft-driven process that people would consider a lot of beer to have. But at the same time, I think, you know, what Athletic Brewing has done so well is really, you know, emphasize the different flavors that they have with their non-alcoholic beer. But I think really, in general, you know, when Bill was entering this market in 2015, there was a large stigma around the market. And I mean, I guess, what even did the market of non-alcoholic beer look like in 2015?
Yeah, I mean, again, this isn't that long ago, but traditionally, the concept is if you had non-alcoholic beer, that was because you couldn't handle your alcohol, right? You were a recovering alcoholic. You had liver issues. You had some or other ailment that if you could be drinking alcohol, you would have. And so the reality is that that's the stigma, right? Whether or not you decided that you didn't want to get plastered on a Thursday night, or, you know, you just wanted something to kind of mingle socially, customers inherently chose not to drink because of health reasons where they said, if you do this, you're going to die, right? If you continue to consume alcohol, you're going to die. And so you pair this with this idea that the lack of non-alcoholic beverages really help, like forces these people to feel out of place at social events. So being at a high-end restaurant or being at a barbecue or professional event, if you don't have something in your hand, you're kind of weird. People are asking, hey, do you want something? That started to change in the 2010s, kind of mid-2010s, where it's really driven by Gen Z. And interesting enough, it's tied to kind of the legalization of marijuana. And so Gen Z has grown up with legalized marijuana in many places, or at least less stigmatized marijuana. And so they are inherently drinking less than older generations. A lot of this was like, hey, you know, my parents said I can't do this, so let me stick it to them, you know, and I'm going to go do this thing. And so actually in 2022, which is the last year I could find statistics, more than a third of U.S. drinkers attempted to have dry January. And so it's really this interesting thing where, you know, the products still suck, but the market has started to warm up to this idea that, hey, maybe I don't need to have tons of alcohol to be socially acceptable.
Yeah, I agree. And I think what's kind of crazy too, as we tell this story, is that, you know, one of the statistics that really stood out to me is that in 2018, non-alcoholic beverages in the US only represented 0.22% of total alcohol sales. So it's literally like not even 0.5% is non-alcoholic beverages, which is pretty crazy to consider how big athletic brewing has gotten today, considering, you know, this was such a small market share. And I'm curious, like, let's say your Bill in 2015, you know, Bill is a trader. He dives into data. He researches a ton. He probably sees these statistics. Like 2015 is probably even less than 0.22% of alcohol sales are non-alcoholic. So I'm curious, like, let's say your Bill, you say, I've got this idea for this non-alcoholic beer. I mean, seeing that statistic, do you get turned away and you're like, there's no market for this? But I think on the inside, you might be saying, well, I want, you know, some avenue to enjoy a beverage when I socialize that's not alcoholic.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think there's two ways to look at this. And the first one was, hey, nobody else is doing this. Maybe we shouldn't do it. And then it's like, hey, nobody else is doing this. Maybe we should do this. Right. So it all depends on how you approach that opportunity. You know, Bill took it almost like a research project to start with. He knew that a lot of people were like him in the sense that they were concerned about their health and that the market was really looking for some sort of socially acceptable, enjoyable, tastes good, non-alcoholic drink that you could bring to parties and that would fit in, right? That would be good. This is also prior to Liquid Death. So like, you know, it's interesting. It's the same sort of trend that both of them are getting at from for different ways. As he started digging into it further, though, he also noticed that the non-alcoholic beer market in Europe was much more developed with different types of beverages. And it was about 10 times more than what they had in the US. And so he saw that, like, okay, this is working elsewhere. It's not working here. And so it kind of reminds me of like this Korea beauty trend that happened in the last 5 or 10 years, where there's been all these sorts of products and all these brands that have been like 30 or 40 years old in Korea that people have said, hey, like, let me go do that. I mean, that's where Hero Cosmetics came from and said, hey, I have this pimple patch that, you know, you can get in Korea all the time. Let me take it, put a, you know, branded as a US entity, US consumer, and like, they did well. They had a huge exit to Church & Dwight. And so I think that he looks at this and says, all right, I know I can borrow what's going on in Europe. I can change some things and we'll figure it out. But very quickly, he realized that even the stuff from Europe wasn't very good because, again, you had some of these breweries that were spending, in some cases, months or years aging this beer, getting it to be a certain consistency, and then they were just burning off the alcohol and it was tasting terrible. And so he recognized that they were going to need an entirely different process to make something that tasted as good as regular beer. And, you know, it kind of reminds me of I don't know if you've had like Impossible Meat or Beyond Meat or things like that. I find that when they try to make something that's plant-based that is like, hey, this tastes like a hamburger, that's really hard to do. But if they just make something that tastes good and I don't know that it's supposed to be a hamburger, I like it a lot more. So it's really difficult. But anyway, so they started to work this. He recognized that there was no process. There were no co-packers that he worked with. And he needed to find somebody who had this expertise to basically challenge 9,000 years worth of brewing history.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy because, I mean, keep in mind, you know, he's not like a beer expert by any means, right? I mean, he doesn't necessarily know the ins and outs of brewing. Bill, you know, really is not like a technical founder by any means. And I think this is where a lot of founders stop, right? They realize, hey, I don't really know how to do this. I don't have the background in this. But, you know, what he did do is he started posting online forums to kind of try to figure out and talk to people that, you know, knew about brewing beer better than he did, you know, brewmasters, and tried to understand, you know, who would be interested in what he called the most innovative sector in craft beer, which is
a little time you take there, yeah.
Yeah, which is pretty funny in terms of his angle. But it sounds like he started running kind of, you know, different type of quote unquote ads and listings in these different forums to try to find someone that could be his brewmaster. And that's when he met his co-founder, John Walker, who, you know, basically he kind of had to convince, like, hey, this is a great opportunity. But John had some, you know, stronger qualifications when it came to beer. John was originally from Connecticut, found his way to New Mexico. And prior to meeting Bill, he had worked for 6 years as the head brewer on Second Street Brewery. And at the time, he was looking to move back to Connecticut. So when Bill posted in one of these forums looking for someone to help him with a innovative new beer, he decided to give it a go. So John flew from New Mexico after the initial call, and they started talking about the idea. And so this kind of seemed like a way for John to move his family back. And, you know, Bill saw him as someone that was crazy enough to say yes, that had, you know, 6 years of experience as a brewmaster. So I think it's like, you know, kind of a funny match made in one of these online forums, but, you know, as we'll find out, it worked out.
Yeah. I was wondering if John ever went by Johnny Walker, because I think that'd be just an even more embellished story at that point. So John moves back to Connecticut and they decide they're going to open up a brewery. So they rent about 10,000 square feet and they're like, all right, we're going to figure this out. And so they start buying a bunch of home brewing equipment, because that's the nice thing about the craft beer industry is you can get a lot of this stuff on a small scale and get it commercially. And they knew that this market was underserved and that they needed to figure it out. And so they started to try to make an IPA. And according to John, it took about over 100 different iterations before they had found something that tasted good that didn't have the alcohol. And just imagine that. I mean, you're there for a year, just constantly trying things, saying this tastes bad, this one was okay, you know, and it's just like pouring money and pouring ingredients down the drain. I mean, do you think there was ever a point there where they were like, hey, you know, this was fun, but maybe there's a reason that, you know, almost 10,000 years worth of history have not been able to crack this?
Yeah, I mean, I think too, because up to that point, you know, most companies that were creating non-alcoholic beer were basically just trying to strip the alcohol out of the regular beer, which, you know, probably wasn't the best process for the beer or for the taste at all. And that's why, you know, most non-alcoholic beer before Athletic Brewing didn't taste well. And so I think, yeah, they were probably pulling their hair out, trying to figure out, okay, what do we do here? And, you know, they kind of from the get-go were generating the new non-alcoholic beer using regular beer equipment. And so I guess from a scalability standpoint, that was a smart decision, because, you know, regular brewing facilities and equipment could be repurposed. But they, you know, struggled to, I think, get the formula right at first, which was a real challenge for them. And I mean, I think it happens to so many founders when you go out and you try to start something, whether it be a cosmetics brand or a alcohol brand or whatever it may be. I mean, I'm, you know, close friends in what's called with the founders of Juneshine, which is like a hard kombucha brand that's done really well the past few years. And I mean, they used to kind of have like tasting parties where like they'd be brewing hard kombucha out of a garage and trying to figure out, okay, what's kind of the flavor profile that makes sense? You know, how do we dial this in? And it was a really lengthy iterative process. I mean, I think it took like a year to really get their first few flavors dialed in.
Yeah. Well, it's also one of those things where you have to have something that tastes good and is worthwhile, but it's also repeatable, right? It doesn't do you any good to have like the perfect concoction that tastes wonderful. You're like, oh, how do we do that? Do we add this or that? Or, you know, oh, you know, so-and-so sneezed on it and that's why it tasted good. So it's really difficult to be scientific about it and say, okay, you know, we're going for this type of undertone. So like, let's increase or decrease this portion of the ingredients, or let's change when we heat it up, or let's change the temperature. And so you think about all these things where they have, you know, dozens of different variables that they could play with, and then how you go through and make sure that you are being scientific and not changing too many things at once in order to get to where you need to be. And this is really what Bill and John did, was they had this agile process and they just started iterating. They focused on two main products, which was an IPA and a golden beer. And they kind of triangulated on what worked, what didn't work. And sometimes you have to intentionally try things and know that it didn't work so that you can rule off that course of thought. And they got there. And, you know, it took them about 40 iterations just to understand that, like, okay, this actually is worth doing and it was going to be worthwhile. And so they had to do another 60 or so to get to a point where it was helpful and it was going to be there. But, you know, at the end, they ended up getting to a proprietary method that allowed them to ferment beer with less than 0.5% alcohol by volume. And so, in other words, this is a beer that was made in the same sort of traditional manner as historical beers, but it had less alcohol than a piece of rye bread. And just think about it. I mean, they literally re-engineered something that had thousands of years been done the same way, and they were able to get the exact output that they wanted that tasted well and did things that way. And also, you know, they were able to have something that had a better profile than the competitors, but it was low carb and healthy. So they really had this winning product, and they took that year or so to zero in on it. And now they feel that the market's starting to change. It's certain people are a little bit more acceptable to it. And now they have a product that they're proud of, which is really exciting.
Yeah. I mean, I think this was a breakthrough for them, right? Because before this, there wasn't really any non-alcoholic beer companies that were able to have this fermentation process that enabled them to have, you know, under 0.5% ABV, which, you know, is considered non-alcoholic. And so I think that was a huge unlock for them. I think before that, most non-alcoholic, you know, brewing companies or beer companies were trying to, you know, take the alcohol out after they had gone through that regular process. So this fermentation process was a game changer for them. You know, it took them a bit of time to get there, but then they kind of faced, you know, this huge stigma around non-alcoholic beer, right? So they kind of solved the taste problem, which was awesome, probably a huge relief. And they're like, okay, well, we've got a product now that tastes pretty good, but there's still this, you know, huge market stigma out there. And I guess, I mean, one question I have is, do you think they were like intentional with naming their company Athletic Brewing? Because it does seem like it's rooted in, you know, their training for marathons, and they want to kind of really hone in on that market. I mean, it seems like a very kind of bland name, if you will, in some sense. It's not like some creative, crazy name. I mean, and this is, keep in mind, at the time where you had all these craft breweries that were coming out with, you know, crazy names left and right. And so to just name this Athletic Brewing, I think it's to the point, but it's kind of bland, if you ask me.
Yeah, my first thought is like this was a new kind of hot yoga phase where people could, you know, work out while they were brewing beer. And I'm like, that actually would probably do pretty well in a place like Vermont, maybe. But no, you're absolutely right. They were entirely intentional about what they called their company and the aesthetic. And so they wanted to have a name that was positive and youthful, and that, you know, people would only feel good about, right? Like Liquid Death, very different sort of feeling. Like that's meant to be like, oh, wow, like, what is this? Like, let me read the label really closely here. This is meant to be like, oh, okay, this is a healthy beer, at the very, very least. They made their cans to be very fashionable. Like it was minimalistic, it was attractive to younger generations. Their cans look good. And they wanted to also make sure that their company was diverse and sustainable. And so they started to publicly back initiatives in nature and sports and things like that. And so they wanted to not scare people away with the branding, but they knew that if they could get people to try the product, they had a pretty good likelihood that they would come back and buy it and try it again. And so they really made sampling a core aspect of how they came to market. One of my favorite stories is that they would give away, you know, free cans at events, but they would stand at the end of marathons, like where they finish and they're kind of walking through and all jelly legged, or even at Olympic events, and they'd be passing out these cans right at the end. And people would look at this like, what, you're giving me beer? I just ran a marathon. Like, what are you doing here? But they were tasty. They were alcohol free. They were low on carbs. And so, you know, these athletes were like, hey, this is great. This is awesome. Like, this is exactly what I want. You know, at the end, I didn't want to have to get drunk after I just ran 26 miles, but it was this great thing that was there.
Yeah. I mean, I think they really honed in on that niche. And so that was their main focus, right? And so they really made sure that they were at the end of these different marathons, at these different, you know, triathlons and different events to give people tastings of Athletic Brewing. I mean, it is a pretty incredible story up to this point, because I think we have to kind of flash back that, you know, their first year is 2019, right? But, you know, when he kind of set out to start, and when his wife Jackie said, hey, you should do this, that was 2015. So he's been kind of ideating, testing, working on this concept for 4 years before he launches, which is a long time, right? I mean, their first year of business, full year of business was 2019. And so they honed in on that niche. That year, they ended up doing about $2.5 million in their first year, which, you know, is nice. It's not incredible. It's not amazing. But hey, that's a nice first year of business, right?
It's not validation. Like,
yeah, it's validation, right? That's a good way to put it. And so, you know, I think it was a interesting dynamic because they moved to a larger brewery in Milford, Connecticut, and they opened another one on the West Coast. So now they've got, you know, East Coast and West Coast. And despite being on track from the beginning with, you know, some funding and data to back them up, a stroke of kind of quote unquote luck, if you will, the COVID-19 pandemic really, I think, helped them grow quite a bit. Do you want to talk about the impact of COVID on Athletic Brewing?
Yeah, it's really funny because I feel like the further we get away from COVID, the more of this sentiment of, man, how lucky were we that we went through COVID, at least from an e-commerce perspective, seems to come out over and over again. So it's just weird how it was so bad when we were going through it. But now people looking at it like, oh, those were the good old days, right? That's when everything was up and to the right. But, you know, COVID was really hard for a lot of people. There was depression, there was anxiety. We literally had no idea what was happening, if the world was ending, what it was going to be like. I mean, people were just scared. And so as a result, you know, if you're kind of hanging around, not working, not seeing other people, day drinking became a big thing. And so there was a dramatic rise in alcohol consumption. And as that happened, people started to recognize that, hey, this probably isn't a great activity from a health perspective. And also at the same time, people weren't going places. And so they had a lot of free time on their hands. They're willing to try new things. And so you see that there's this confluence of factors going on where people are consuming these beverages. They recognize that it's probably not healthy, that they want some other stuff. They're willing to try new things because they're stuck at home. And so now there's this new crop of non-alcoholic beers that people are willing to give a shot. And really the key thing here is that they were able to exploit this concept that they termed a virtual tap room. And so you think about really just the nature of the pandemic. People were afraid to go to the store. You know, bars were closed. People were just afraid to see other people, but they still needed things sent to them. And so non-alcoholic beer, because there's no alcohol in it, it's not regulated, it can be delivered by any regular mail carrier, USPS, FedEx, UPS. And so Athletic Brewing had set up an e-commerce company, and they were able to deliver these orders as normal. And any of the alcoholic companies, they couldn't do that, right? If you are an alcohol startup or you're trying to deliver alcohol, it's a state-by-state basis. You have to get a license. Only certain people are allowed to distribute. Only certain people are allowed to deliver. You have to make sure that the person receiving the package is able to sign for it and that they're, you know, of age to consume that. And so there's a lot of barriers and friction that are inherently put in place by the regulations for alcoholic beverages that didn't have to happen. So if I'm somebody who was stuck inside and I basically consumed my stash of alcohol and, you know, I want something else. I don't want to drink water, but I also don't want to go out. And I can see that I can just have something sent to me and I start to see reviews that are doing pretty well. Well, I'm going to give it a try. And so people did that. And as a result, these e-commerce sales for Athletic Brewing more than doubled in the first year. And really it was kind of the beginning of the end as far as the stigma for non-alcoholic beverages. Because, you know, on the one hand, people used to be ashamed to be seen with a non-alcoholic drink at a bar or a party situation. Well, now here they are trying it out in their home and, you know, they don't have to have that public stigma. And, you know, they're also saying, hey, this is actually pretty good. Like this is really good. I feel good about it. I don't have the negative side effects. And so you start to see these things start to change. And I don't know if Athletic Brewing could have grown as quickly as it did had it not had the circumstances where people were given an incentive and an excuse to step back and to try something they normally wouldn't have tried in the privacy of their own home. And you know, even you start to see celebrities doing this where I think Carly Kloss, the supermodel, she tried it while she was pregnant and it was just like, hey, this is great. I love this.
Yeah. It's pretty incredible to see how COVID affected some businesses in a very positive way and obviously some in a very, very negative way. And I mean, it's just an incredible story to see how their team navigated COVID to build Athletic Brewing. I mean, during COVID and kind of the last few years, beer sales have been relatively flat in America. But I think the market for, you know, non-alcoholic beers, non-alcoholic beverages is growing a lot. So total revenue is up 20%. Between the summer of 2021 and 2022, there was over $330 million in non-alcoholic beverage sales. And, you know, Athletic Brewing did a good job tapping into that market and really, you know, created that virtual tap room that did super well for them. So 2017, this is kind of a bit of their timeline. 2017, they raised a $3 million seed round. And this is where they really, you know, start tinkering in with that fermentation process where they could, you know, brew their beer with under a 0.5% ABV level. 2019, they do $2.5 million in revenue. They raise a $3.9 million Series A. 2020, they do $15 million in revenue and raise a 17.5 Series B. 2021, they do $37 million in revenue and raise a $50 million Series C. 2022, they do $60 million in revenue and raise a $75 million Series D. And so it's, I mean, pretty incredible growth, right? I mean, almost doubling. Well, I guess 2019 to 2020, they just take off like crazy. But after that, basically, you know, doubling every year, which is incredible to do, I think, as a beverage company like this. They are, you know, very heavily capitalized. I just wonder, you know, would they have been able to raise this amount of capital for this business had it not been a zero interest environment at that time? You know, they are very well capitalized hitting those revenue targets. But Athletic Brewing Company was selected as the second fastest growing food and beverage company in the US in 2022. So that's pretty incredible. Athletic Brewing accounted for 20% of all US non-alcoholic beer sales in 2022. Athletic is sold in over 10,000 restaurants and bars, which is just amazing to see. And it's been pretty incredible because I know it was reported as well, I think last year, that they became the number one beer in Whole Foods, which is just pretty insane. So 2023, it's estimated that they did $90 million in revenue, and they had some pretty cool activations and partnerships with like Netflix to launch a limited edition line connected to the Witcher's new season. And they also partnered up with like JetBlue and some other airlines to offer, you know, Athletic Brewing on their flight. So, I mean, what do you think about that growth, Aaron? It's pretty incredible, but also they are very well capitalized and in a position to take advantage of that, you know, zero interest rate environment.
Yeah. You know, I think my first gut is like, hey, maybe did they raise too much capital? You know, anytime you're raising more capital around than your revenue, that's always one of those things where it's like, all right, well, there better be a really good reason why you have that. You know, a good reason would be, hey, we're building a new brewery. We have CapEx. We have all the sort of stuff that we're putting into. So it looks like that's a lot of where they spent the money. Bad reasons would be more along the lines of like, oh yeah, we're just going to market more, or like, you know, we're going to have a bigger team. Those are less good reasons. So I think digging in under the hood there and really understanding the reason for why they raise that amount is important. But I mean, you can't argue the fact that they have effectively created a category. And I think that is so important and so interesting for people to understand, is that really when you are going out to not just create a brand, but create an entire category that didn't exist before, and you're going to be basically the benchmark that every other competitor comes after and says, oh yeah, we are like X. That's something that is really to be commended. It is difficult to do. And it's really something that, you know, probably needed all this capital and was really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, they expanded the category, right? I mean, they definitely expanded the category, and they did so in an incredible way. They've won, you know, so many different prizes in business and marketing and PR and product. I mean, they've done so well across the board. And they've also, I think what's kind of crazy is they've won brewery awards, beating, you know, best in class alcoholic beer brands as well. So goes to show, you know, Athletic Brewing actually, you know, tastes better than beer to a lot of people, which is pretty amazing to see how they've accomplished that from a taste profile perspective. What does their supply chain look like, Aaron?
Yeah, so it's pretty interesting. So their interesting part, at least from my perspective, is their manufacturing base. So they started out with a brewery in Stratford, Connecticut, and they very quickly needed a bigger space. And so they opened up an additional plant in San Diego and one in Milford, which we talked about earlier. And the idea is that these entities, especially the Milford site, is now the largest brewery that's dedicated to non-alcoholic brewing. They can make about 6 million cases each year, which is a lot of cases. And they can, between their West Coast and their East Coast facility, they can have a maximum capacity of about 650,000 barrels of non-alcoholic beer. And so they've got some real skill they've built there. And, you know, they have had to do some sourcing of like cans and things like that from outside the US. But in general, they have built their own factory and their own supply base. And kind of a question I have for you, Nathan, you know, kind of being the manufacturing guy, is, you know, in my perspective, it's pretty rare that you get a company that has created an entirely unique process and in some cases had to or was forced to self-manufacture because there weren't co-packers there or available. Would you ever recommend that they outsource their brewing?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think at this point in time, they have that infrastructure set up. They've spent the CapEx. I mean, that's probably why they had to raise quite a bit of money, you know, to expand their footprint to brew their non-alcoholic beer. So I think at this point, I'm not quite sure it would make sense for them to work with a co-packer because that they have that process so dialed in with their own facilities. But obviously running your own facilities has, you know, positives and negatives to it. I mean, on the plus side, they control their whole supply chain, which is awesome. You know, on the negative side, they, you know, probably have even more cash flow challenges at times when it comes to ordering raw materials and holding raw materials and all of that. You know, I can only imagine their balance sheet having, you know, a lot of raw material on it, which most e-commerce brands do not have, right? And so I think it's interesting to, you know, debate and see, you know, okay, well, they've got this strong base. They could probably also offer co-packing services to other brands, right? You know, let's say you're a Budweiser and you say, hey, I need more capacity for my non-alcoholic line. I'm not quite sure Athletic Brewing is set up to do that today, but, you know, from a revenue expansion standpoint, that's something that they could explore if they opened up a channel for co-packing. But I think what they've really leaned into and what, you know, their supply chain has been so strong with is their distribution. So they have their direct-to-consumer channel, which really took off during COVID, and they have retail and hospitality. I mean, retail, like we said, I think is just such a magnet for them. I mean, being the best-selling beer in Whole Foods, that is huge. I can only imagine the activation they have within Whole Foods to get there. And then also, I think it's, you know, pretty cool for them to do airline partnerships with JetBlue and stuff of that nature. But I think Bill and John, the founders, really kind of saw their offering as complementary to alcoholic drinks and not as like a substitute, right? I think like if I'm at a bar and don't want to drink, I now have the option to drink a non-alcoholic beer that tastes good. And that is, you know, pretty amazing to see that they've really carved out this niche. I mean, I'm curious, have you seen people drinking Athletic Brewing out in the wild before? I've seen them. I think I saw one at a half marathon here in Utah once, and I was like, oh, that's super cool to see, you know?
You probably thought like, oh man, that marathoner's got a real alcohol problem, don't they?
Yeah, I've
seen that at conference and stuff like that. And, you know, you wouldn't know that it's non-alcoholic. It looks and feels the same. It just, you know, from what you can tell, it doesn't have the alcohol.
Yeah, it's interesting. So, you know, I think they've really expanded their footprint and it's become, you know, more commonplace to see people that you think are drinking beer drink a non-alcoholic beer, which is pretty cool. So I think on one hand, you know, their supply chain is super strong that enables them to have this great footprint. I think on the other hand, you know, they've really kind of, in my mind, gotten past that social stigma of, you know, providing a great beverage for people not interested in drinking alcohol. And when I see someone drinking Athletic, you know, beer, Athletic Brewing, it's not because I think they have like an alcohol problem. It's because I think they probably just, you know, don't want to drink beer right now. And that's a great option for them, right? So I think kind of the unlock to me is they've gotten past that stigma.
Yeah, I think you're right. And, you know, the really interesting thing about them is they have not only created a category, but they've also changed perceptions. And part of this is, yeah, they were riding a general trend that was there, but they did a lot to contribute to that and to get that to be part of the conversation. And I think it kind of comes back to their distribution strategy as well, where unlike traditional alcohol companies, e-commerce is a huge opportunity for them. you know, it helps them to be able to engage with customers, to you know, to not only ship and sell directly D2C through the shipping networks, but they get really quick feedback and they can help that word of mouth that goes through. And then they partner on with that data to say, hey, you know, let's go to Whole Foods and say, hey, you know, we're getting a lot of traction in Charlotte. I think that we should be increasing, or we should be doing a promotion there because we're doing a lot of D2C orders there. Let's do a co-marketing thing to drive people there. And so it's this really virtuous cycle of what they're doing, where they're finding new customers, they're converting them. The products aren't that expensive. I mean, looking on the website, you can get a 6-pack or 12-pack for $50, and that's including shipping. And you imagine just, again, shipping liquid, that's pretty expensive just from a cost point of view. But you can get a sampler pack, you can get a mixer pack. They're, you know, you can get this delivered via Amazon or, you know, with Whole Foods. And so they're really doing a lot there to get people to just try it, because they know that if people try it, if they at all like something like this, it's going to be something that they're going to come back and buy again and again and again. And the next time that they're in a store, they will not hesitate about picking up a 12 pack.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's awesome. I mean, they've also done so well with this kind of like blue ocean strategy, right? I can't really think of any other e-commerce brand that's kind of employed a similar approach. I mean, I think most brands like see a growing market and they tap into it, where I think like Athletic Brewing was really more so like, hey, we're gonna grow this market. I'm curious, do any brands come to mind that have a similar kind of blue ocean strategy?
I mean, there's quite a few, but maybe we should just define blue ocean in case people don't aren't aware. Yeah, so basically it comes out of this this book that was written. I forget the name of the author, but you can find it on Amazon. And the idea is that there are some markets that are so competitive that you think about like fish fighting in the ocean, and they're red oceans, right? Everybody's fighting for market share. It's a race to the bottom from a pricing perspective. And just think about kind of the feeding frenzy that happens there. And that's because everybody's going after the same customer with the same product and the same pitches. Well, if you change the paradigm and you look at this and say, all right, what is a completely different offering that we could have? What's a different market that we could have? What is a different way we can go compete where there aren't as many sharks in the water? And it's a blue ocean compared to a red ocean. That's the framework. And so what they were able to do is they said, all right, we're not going to go out and create a new alcohol company. And we're not going to go after and compete against Anheuser-Busch or Heineken or things like that. What we're going to do is we're going to go over here where there are no real brands when it comes to non-alcoholic beers. And we're going to make something that is done completely different than how other people do it. And this is just what we're going to do. And so they had this really interesting framework where they felt that their mandate, they had a dual mandate to not only grow the company, but also grow the category. And they were able to push through and really just execute well.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's incredible to see their execution. I mean, they are like, I think the market leader in non-alcoholic beer right now, at least in Whole Foods. Yeah. And I mean, it's just incredible to see what they've done with the market. What do you think their exit opportunities look like? I mean, yeah, I'm curious what comes to mind.
Yeah. So this kind of comes back to that first rule that we always talk about. And, you know, it is, are they profitable? And so I didn't find anything to confirm or dissuade the fact that they were profitable or were not profitable. But let's assume that they are. If they do, then they completely own their destiny. They are in complete control. They have a strong process, a strong moat around the process for developing beer without alcohol. They own their own breweries. And it's going to take some time for other competitors to figure this out or for that knowledge or process to leak out. And so they have a huge head start and a huge opportunity to continue to own these sorts of things, own this space, if they are a default live company and they're profitable. They're also really successfully changing the narrative around non-alcoholic beers and just normalizing this consumption. Just to throw some statistics at you, 80% of Athletic Brewing customers also drink alcohol. And many of those customers are, when they're consuming it, they're alternating between drinking Athletic and drinking another alcoholic drink so they can be social without binging every time they want to be social. And so what they've done is they've literally created something that consumers are treating as equal to traditional beers in social situations. And so it's just this really strong thing that, again, if they're profitable, the world's their oyster. They could be as big as they want to be. Now, let's suppose that they're not profitable, or for whatever reason, they do want to exit and there's some liquidity there. They do have some options around exits. And so some more statistics, non-alcoholic beer accounts for about 85% of a growing market of what they call, quote unquote, unintoxicating beverages. or intoxicating beverages. And you look at Anheuser-Busch, so AB InBev, they are about $57 billion in sales. And they've said that they want their non-alcoholic and low-alcoholic beers to be about 20% of their global beer sales by 2025. So it's a very clear mandate from the largest manufacturer in the world that, hey, this is a growing area. We want something in this space. Either we're going to buy it or we're going to build it ourselves. I actually don't think that there's going to be an alcohol brand that's going to buy them, though. I think that, you know, for AB InBev, for example, to want to purchase Athletic, they're going to need to have a belief that there's a large amount of volume in sales to really make a dent. So even at $100 million in revenue today, does Anheuser-Busch really believe that Athletic Brewing is going to be a $10 billion brand, right? Like, you think about $57 billion, that's just a lot of volume you have to have in order to make a difference on top of the baseline. And so you think about that too, and AB InBev's infrastructure is really keyed around traditional brewing methods. And even though the overall alcohol market may be declining, there's still a lot of profit that can be made. And just think about, you know, other industries that are seeing a decline as well. So whether that's Philip Morris or Altria that are making tobacco, those are just profit-making machines. And even though tobacco consumption is declining in general, they just set this up and said, hey, you know, we're okay with that because we are so efficient at making profits that our shareholders are rewarding us that for it. So it's really interesting that, you know, well, I guess before I keep going, what are your thoughts there about, do you think that if they're acquired, it's going to be an alcoholic brand that does that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting take. I think, you know, I think one thing that stuck out to me is that the largest, you know, player in the space, AB InBev, believes that 20% of their sales is going to come from non-alcoholic brands, which, you know, probably 10 years ago, they didn't think that was the truth and going to happen. And so I think, you know, Athletic Brewing is in a great position to continue to grow into this market. I think, you know, with the distribution that a company like AB InBev has, I do think they could grow it to a multi-billion dollar brand. That's for sure, just given the distribution power that they have. But I don't know if it's a great fit for them. I mean, like you said, AB InBev does have, like, you know, Bud Zero and some other non-alcoholic beer brands that they have themselves. But yeah, it's just crazy to me that, you know, 10 years ago, I bet you AB InBev or, you know, these Anheuser-Busch, you know, large brands didn't think this non-alcoholic market was going to grow so quickly. And today they're saying 20% of their sales are going to come from non-alcoholic beer in the future. That's pretty crazy.
Yeah, it is. And so you think about, where does Athletic Brewing make sense from an acquisition point of view? And to me, I think it makes more sense for a company to purchase them that doesn't have any exposure to alcohol at all. And the thought here is that as people are transitioning from alcoholic beverages to non-alcoholic beverages, an acquirer could see this as an opportunity to bring in new customers versus just converting old ones. And so the clear answer here is soda companies. And so as we talked about with the Liquid Death episode, you know, Coke and Pepsi have a history of paying a few billion dollars for products that fill a need in their portfolio. And so it's not outside the realm of possibility that in a few years, one of these big soda companies could decide that they're going to purchase them. And, you know, Keurig Dr. Pepper actually bought a 10% stake in Athletic Brewing for about $50 million as part of their Series D. And so they have the inside track, and they're probably going to be the ones that acquire the rest of the business. And so there's an element here where, you know, once this happens, I think it's going to set off an arms race in big soda. And I think that the second and third non-alcoholic beers that come into this space that taste just as good as Athletic are going to have much bigger exits to Coke and Pepsi than Athletic will to Keurig Dr. Pepper. And so just, you know, reasons for that. If you look at from a market cap point of view, Dr. Pepper is about $48 billion. That's a big company. But Pepsi is $195 billion and Coke is $256 billion. So just the willingness to pay to create a category and to get much bigger there is much higher. So to some extent, you know, it was good that they got that $50 million in. It was good validation. They probably definitely needed the money, but they probably played that card a little bit too soon. Whereas I think that Coke or Pepsi would have been willing to pay a lot more for them than Keurig will eventually.
Yeah, I think because now, you know, Dr. Pepper and Keurig, they kind of have that inside scope in how Athletic Brewing's doing. So they can kind of know when they should really, you know, bite and take all of the apple instead of just 10%, right? So I think you're right. I mean, who knows if there was like an option to be like a, you know, first take on a potential exit when Athletic Brewing looks to sell, right? Maybe, you know, there's some term in the original investment that says, hey, you know, we have that option to take a first look here, which, you know, I think can be commonplace in some of these deals with larger companies that have incredible distribution. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't know, like at the time, if I was, you know, the founder of Athletic Brewing, I probably would have taken that check from Dr. Pepper Keurig anyway, just because it's a great investment. They have the distribution, they have the operating excellence and expertise. It makes a lot of sense to, you know, align with them, but maybe they were thinking small at the time. I mean, what do you think?
Well, look, it was also an enormous validation. I mean, you have a $48 billion company that wants to put $50 million into your company. And so this definitely put them on the map. It probably needed to happen. I just think that, you know, like, could Coke or Pepsi still buy them? Yes. But let's suppose they spend $1 billion to buy them. They're going to give $100 million to Dr. Pepper, which is a direct competitor. So, like, that's one of those things where, like, you know, I don't really want to do that. But I agree with you. I think that I probably would have taken the check as well. I just think when founders are thinking about taking money from strategics, you just have to recognize that you're, even though you're opening one door and you're taking a step through that door, you're also closing two or three other ones. So you just have to be cognizant of that and be willing to deal with those consequences.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. That's a good point. And what an incredible story, Athletic Brewing. I mean, I think 10 years ago, you know, most of us would have probably thought this was a bad idea, and to see how they've not only grown the market, but really just caught wind with this whole, you know, new way of a lifestyle, I mean, there's so many people now that are running more than I've ever seen, you know, marathons, triathlons, training more, becoming more health conscious. I mean, I really think, you know, Athletic Brewing is going to continue to grow amazingly well in the next few years. What do you think their future holds, Aaron?
I think the key is can they continue as a ongoing entity? Are they profitable? And so the brand will definitely continue. The process is going to continue. Do they have the economics to support an ongoing business? And if the answer is yes, then I think that we're going to see a lot more. And this is really just the opening inning for what they're going to be able to accomplish.
Yeah. Yeah. This was a great episode of E-commerce on Tap. And if you want to hear more episodes like this, I would tune in episode 10. We talked about Liquid Death, which I'm drinking right now. It's one of my favorite water and now flavored water brands. Their story is a lot different than Athletic Brewing, but it is cool to see another beverage company just grow incredibly well. And I think there's a lot of opportunity in this space, right? I think it's a really interesting category. Athletic Brewing is doing tremendously well. If you enjoyed this episode, take a screenshot right now of you listening, post it on Twitter or LinkedIn, share your thoughts with us. Do you think Athletic Brewing is going to sell to Keurig Dr. Pepper? Let Aaron and I know. We're both on Twitter, LinkedIn, and we really appreciate everyone listening in to this episode of E-commerce on Tap, brought to you by Sourcify and ISBA.